Well, it appears we have Robert Weiss on the line, so we'll go to him. Sexual addiction is a growing problem that is fueled by the Internet. It's a problem that is only getting worse, and our next guest has been described as the foremost expert on sexual addiction in the United States. Robert Weiss is the Senior Vice President of Clinical Development at Elements Behavioral Health, and he founded the Sexual Recovery Institute in Los Angeles in 1995, and he's the author of a number of books. His upcoming book to be released this year is Closer Together, Further Apart, The Effect of Technology and the Internet on Sex, Intimacy, and Relationships. We're pleased to have with us today Robert Weiss. Robert, thanks for joining us.
It's certainly a pleasure. Glad to join you.
Tell me your story and how you became involved with the issue of sexual addiction.
Well, I became interested in this area when I saw people who knew that they shouldn't be having unsafe sex, and they knew that they might or might not be HIV positive or could become HIV positive, and they were having unsafe sex anyway back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I was already in the field of mental health, and I became really curious about why is it that people would make really poor decisions around sexual behavior when they knew better. And so why is it that you might think this is a bad idea, I probably shouldn't do it, like so many of our people in the media these days, and yet they do it anyway. And that really led me to the area of compulsive and addictive sexual disorders, that there are some people, a small percentage of the population, just like alcoholics, who when they get into a lot of recreational sexual behavior, they kind of run off the rails. And they make mistakes that other people would know better than to make it, if you will.
Now, Robert, I've heard professionals say that addictions are the result of trauma at some point early in our lives, and our addictions are the way we medicate ourselves to that trauma. Mm-hmm. Others have described that as nonsense. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I think that there is no black and white answer to that. There is genetic predisposition toward addiction. If you have a parent who is an alcoholic or a drug addict, I think you have an over 50% likelihood that one of your siblings will be an alcoholic or a drug addict. So we clearly know there's genetic predisposition. But then there's also genetic predisposition for being emotionally vulnerable, for having personality challenges. And lots of people go through various traumas in their lives and they don't become addicts. So, you know, it isn't a straight line like that. I think of it more as those people who struggle here's the best way of thinking about it. When you have a bad day or I have a bad day, hopefully what we do is we, you know, go for some exercise, we talk to a friend, we relax, we make ourselves feel better. When addicts are having a bad day, they, rather than kind of calming themselves down or going to a quieter place or a relaxing place or a connecting place, they more go toward intensity. So an addict will go gamble or will go spend money or will go have sex with a whole bunch of people or put themselves in that kind of environment because the way they manage their emotional challenges is by kind of going toward intensity rather than calming themselves down. I think that, and lots of people have that issue, trauma-based issue, can be a personality-based issue, could be a social issue. It's different for different people.
Yeah, going toward intensity. I've never heard that before. That's very interesting.
Well, gamblers do it, right?
Yeah,
we see that with gambling disorders. If you think about spending disorders, really what addiction is about, the genetic piece aside, it's about pleasure-seeking.
Yeah.
And, in fact, that's what defines an addiction from a compulsion. Compulsions are things that people do over and over again to alleviate anxiety, make themselves feel better, even though they aren't pleasurable, like washing your hands or over and over again because you think that there's, you know, a bacteria in the house, or checking the stove 12 times each morning to make sure that you didn't leave it on, even though you know you didn't leave it on. I mean, that would be more compulsive behavior. And there's really not a lot of pleasure in checking the stove or washing your hands. But when it comes to repetitive patterns of behavior or substance use that involve pleasure, that people seek out as a means of escape or, as you said, soothing themselves, calming themselves down, et cetera, then they're addictions because they are both pleasurable and they're repeated not for the pleasure they provide in and of themselves, but as a means of emotional escape or emotional stability.
Robert, I think you've answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why do some people resort to alcohol, others food, some sex, some shopping, all sorts of
things? Great question. We have no idea. There's not nearly clearly enough neurobiological research. We're not at the point yet where we kind of understand that some people are pre-programmed toward alcohol addiction. You can understand, for example, I'm not an alcoholic, and I never could be, because when I drink, my body metabolizes alcohol very quickly, and pretty soon after the fun part wears off, I start getting a headache, I get tired, I get dry mouth. But there are other people whose bodies metabolize alcohol very slowly, so they experience pleasurable effects for long periods of time before they get the headache and the tiredness. And the, so that person would be more genetically predisposed toward an alcohol addiction, if you will. But that's not true for all addictions.
No, I'm with you on the alcohol part. The Internet has given us a view of sex that previous generations never had. How has that impacted our relationships?
Well, I don't think that it's I think every generation has had a different view of sexuality than the generation before, and that this has escalated over time. I mean, I grew up in the 1960s, and my parents dated in the 1940s. You know, their experience of dating in the living room with my grandmother in the kitchen listening to see if they were smooching, or only going on double dates because they weren't allowed to go on a single date, you know, as two people. They had to be with four. You know, that level, that sort of control over their sexual behavior, their intimacy choices. You know, people couldn't dance and touch physically. They had to dance and have a distance. You know, all of that stuff in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
By the time I was dating in the 70s, you know, we were playing spin the bottle, and my parents didn't want to come anywhere near us. So, you know, and everyone said sex, drugs, and rock and roll was going to destroy the generation. And, you know, we've had our challenges with that, but for the most part, we've done okay. So I think that we're just seeing really the next turn in the technological wheel, which brings, in every case, brings intensity-based experiences like gambling, like gaming, like sexual behavior, much closer to us. It makes it much more available, much more immediate. So we're going to be affected by that. And some people who have more impulsive or compulsive or emotional vulnerabilities, patterns in their behavior, those people might get sucked in, if you will, to the porn, to the easy hookups. You have to remember that in 1985 or 1990, if I wanted to look at porn, you know, I'd get dressed, take a shower, get in my car, go on the bus, go down to that place downtown that I hope nobody saw me. You know, the floors were sticky, the place was icky, smelled bad. You know, grab my porn and you know, my magazine, my video, and take it home. And, you know, then half the time I had to return it because that stuff was expensive and videos were often rented. But what does it take to look at porn today? You know, I just pull my phone out of my pocket. So that simple... all of those moments where I might have said, do I want to do that? Is that a good idea? Do I really want to go down there? Do I really want to spend an hour looking at porn? I mean, that's all gone now.
Yeah.
And it's just so immediate. So the accessibility to intensely arousing experiences and content leaves some people vulnerable, and not everybody. And I don't think our whole generation is going to go to hell in a handbasket, but I do think there will be some people who maybe they are socially phobic, or they do have trauma, or they have emotional challenges, and they will find it easier to gravitate toward this repetitive pattern of controllable pleasure rather than risking things with partners in the real world.
Now, Robert, because of this prevalence of sexual content that you mentioned, are we losing our capacity for intimacy?
I don't. I think that, first of all, I have actually strong feelings about this. I think that we're in the midst of a generation gap, and it is as profound and meaningful as the generation gap of the 1960s and 70s. It just isn't being carried out in the streets with posters and tie-dye and tear gas. It's being carried out online. And the separation between what anybody who's 40, 50, and 60, how they can see the world versus someone who is 20 or 30 or younger, is becoming increasingly more pronounced. And, you know, this gap really came about through social media and smartphones. It really came about 2008, started to develop. And so, you know, I see older people viewing younger people with a lot of judgment, a lot of fear, a lot of concerns about their sexual behavior, what they're seeing online, that they're all going to be narcissists, they're all going to be unempathic, they spend all their time in machines, you know, all of that stuff that older people tend to say. But when you talk to younger people about their experience, they say that they feel more connected than we are, that mm-hmm. they feel like they're always in each other's space, they're always finding out where each, you know, it may be superficial information. So, you know, an older person says, oh, you know, who cares that Susie had got a sale on butter at the store? You know, I don't want to be on Twitter to find that out. Well, if you look at those media that way, you're not really understanding what they are. Well, they're not just a format for superficial communication. They're a way for people to stay connected all the time.
When you talk about a generation gap, we have become our parents.
Oh, we have definitely become our parents, and worse. You know, I have people say to their kids, you know, I want you to put that tablet away. I want you to get your head out of that computer. You need to go outside and play. You know, your life's going to be ruined. Or, you know, all these kids are not going to know how to communicate. Or how about rudeness? You know, sit at a table with four or five people over the age of 35 and four or five people under the age of 35, and you'll see, feel the tension. You know, the older folks will be, you know, the younger folks will be one end of the table. They're texting and they're using their phones and they're talking and the other end of the table, the older people are clucking, you know, kind of like, oh, look at those kids. They're so rude. I'm right here. They could be talking to me. But if you put a table full of 20-year-olds together, nobody seems to mind.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but when I'm with younger people, I find them to be fun.
Well, I think that's an important, you know, you have to also be willing to, in order to find them fun, you have to be willing to say, well, maybe my view of the world and the way I've grown up isn't the right way. It's just what I'm familiar with. And now there's a different way that I'm not so comfortable with because I didn't grow up with it. But younger people did grow up with it, and they have a different experience of it. They're not wrong, and we're not right. It's just different.
We're talking to Robert Weiss, one of the foremost experts on sexual addiction in the United States. We have to take a break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back. We're talking to Robert Weiss, whose upcoming book, Closer Together, Further Apart. Robert, when's that book coming out?
October.
Now, Robert, talk to me about the study that was conducted of men who were instructed not to change their lives in any way except to spend more time watching porn.
Well, let me back up. What is your thought about that study? Because I'd be curious what it is that you want to look at before I answer your question.
Well, no, I read a bit about it in the Huffington Post, and I thought it'd be interesting for you to tell the story about what sort of reaction men had who were watching, did nothing else but watch more porn.
Well, there are a variety of responses that people are going to have. I can pretty much lay them out. Whatever study you're looking at is that, and this is not just true for men, by the way. This is also true for women.
Okay.
And I really think it's important to say that the problem of compulsive and addictive sexual disorders and the compulsive and addictive pursuit of romantic and sexual relationships is not solely a men's issue. It's an issue that women struggle with too. And increasingly, we have a treatment center in Tennessee called The Ranch, where I have a 12-bed house for women. And, you know, I always thought I would just be doing treatment with men with sexual disorders. And, you know, not surprisingly, I have found a lot of women who struggle with eating disorders and chemical dependency. And when you dig a little bit deeper, you find out that they may or may not have sexual abuse, and they may or may not act out that sexual abuse in adult life with anonymous and compulsive patterns. So just to say, I don't think any of this is exclusive to men. I think men get caught more. Men are not as good as hiding. Men are not apparently as good at hiding as women are in certain ways. But also you have to understand when a man is acting out sexually, you know, he's having sex three times a week with strangers and he's looking at porn 3 hours a day. If he gets caught or in trouble, he'll turn around and say, oh, you know, I have a sex problem. A woman who is hooking up on Match.com or eHarmony 3 days a week and masturbating to porn 3 days a week is going to turn around and say, you know, I think I have a problem with relationships and intimacy. So she won't look at herself as having a sexual problem in the way that a man would.
Why is that? Why is that? Can you explain the difference?
Well, in part, I think it's because, well, I don't think I know, it's men look at sex differently than women do. Men look at the world differently than men. We're built differently.
Yeah.
You know, men tend to be much more readily able to compartmentalize a sexual experience. You know, a man can, and sorry, ladies who are listening, but, you know, a man can typically, let's say, go to Las Vegas on a business trip and go with a bunch of clients to a strip club and get a lap dance or have some experience that is certainly highly sexualized, if not an actual sexual act. And then he'll go home, and if he said to his spouse, well, how was Vegas? And he said, oh, it was great. I got this great lap dance with this beautiful stripper. And then we went on, and we went to dinner, and we had a good time. And, you know, the first thing that spouse is going to say is, I thought you loved me. I mean, why would you do that if you, you know, because to him, it's like exercise. You know, it's like he went to the gym on some level. And I'm not saying all men are built like that. I'm simply saying that men have an easier time compartmentalizing sexual behavior than women do. Women tend to look at it more holistically. So, you know, sex goes along with, do you care about me? Do I have feelings for you? Do I feel safe for you, with you? Is there trust being built between us? And I'm not saying that women don't have casual sex. But even when they do, they often think about it in terms of whether I like this person or not, or how I feel about this person. Men will often look at it more as a visual thing, like I like the body parts that I'm seeing, I like the things I'm touching, and won't think as much about the connection.
Men are wired to procreate, aren't we?
Well, we're certainly we're not as wired to be as concerned about about battening down the hatches at home and keeping home life safe. I don't think we're much more out there in the adventures of the world. That's how our brains are built. Women are more social. You know, they have better time at being social and relational than men do. We tend to compete. You know, this is all Venus versus Mars stuff, but it plays out in sexual behavior, and because men can compartmentalize more readily a casual sexual act, and a woman will tend to see it more as something to do with feelings, the relationship, family life, etc. But I was going to mention your porn study.
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, porn, certainly more men look at porn than women, and when men are more involved with porn than women, and there's a simple reason for that, is that men are more visual. So we are more stimulated by body parts. So if you show men a lot of porn, if you say to a guy, you got to look at porn 4 hours a day, you know, we're going to do some testing on you, what you'll find over a period of a short period of time, maybe a month or so, if he's looking a couple hours a day, is he will objectify globally more people that he sees in the world. He will look, let's say if he's heterosexual, he'll look at women, for example, because he sort of gets trained to looking at body parts and being stimulated by body parts online. So then when he goes out in the world, he is less likely to be relational or relational, I guess that's the best way I can say it, with a woman, and more look at her as body parts. In other words, he will more readily objectify her. Someone who's looking at porn a couple hours a day is more readily going to objectify everyone, including their spouse. So, you know, if you're getting this constant stream of hours and hours of intensely stimulating, arousing, new, fanciful images that turn you on, none of which your spouse could be, because, you know, when you're with someone for 5 years, they just are who they are, you would probably tend to be less interested in spousal sexuality, because the spouse doesn't provide that constant new exciting stimulation that you've been getting from the porn. So, but it doesn't mean you're going to get hooked on it. There are people who will look at it 4 hours a day, and then when they're done with the study, they're done. And within a short period of time, by the way, they will normalize, and they will once again see people not as an objectified way, and they'll be more intimate with their partner. It's only the people I work with who get hooked on it. I guess I want to say something about sex addiction, if that's okay.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, I don't think people have a great understanding of this, and we don't actually in the field really care what you call it, whether it's hypersexuality or hypersexual disorder or sexual compulsion, or a lot of people get hung up on that word addiction, and so I just see it as a pattern of sexual behavior that is interfering with that person's functional life. You know, it's interfering with their job or their health or their family life, and they know it's interfering, whatever sexual behavior they're engaged in, and they keep doing it anyway, and they know it's distracting them from the time of their kids. They know that they got in trouble for it, and yet they seem to be so preoccupied with accessing the porn or calling the ex-girlfriend or boyfriend or constantly having that affair partner, and it eventually overrides their other life priorities. And the way I think about that is like alcoholism, and this is the point that I wanted to give you, is that, you know, lots of people drink. Some people get drunk once in a while. I think the percentages are something like 88 to 90% of the population, the general population, does not have a problem with alcohol. So most people, you know, they have a drink, they relax, they have a beer when they're watching a game or two, maybe they get drunk once in a while. It's not a problem for them. But there is a small percentage of the population, maybe around 8 to 10%, maybe a little bit more, that we call alcoholic. And those people don't get to drink like everyone else, because when they do, their biological predisposition to alcohol kicks in, and they're unable to stop, or they drink more than they should consistently. So those people can't drink like 90% of the population can. And when I think about sexual addiction, I think the same thing. There is a small percentage of the population, not everybody, maybe 5 to 8%, because of trauma, because of personality issues, because of relationship dysfunction, because of their underlying personality and who they are, social phobia, all kinds of issues. They do not seek or are able to attain comfort in intimacy. They prefer recreational, casual, distance form of sexual behavior, even if they're married. They want to go out and do that separately. They want to separate their sex life from their intimate life. And those people are different than everybody else who seems to be able to somehow manage to put sex and love together. And so for those people, just like for the alcoholic, they don't get to engage in recreational, non-relationship-oriented sex, because they will run off the rails with it. And that's kind of somehow, I think, a way to think about sex addiction is it's just a small percentage, and it's just a very, you know, it's just those people who are unable to act in the same way as the rest of us, and that's their vulnerability. That's who they are.
Now, Robert, I think you've explained it extremely well, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Your book, Closer Together, Further Apart, is coming out in October.
Yes, and I have a book called Sex Addiction 101 that was just released recently, and it's sort of a basic description of what sex addiction is. Very inexpensive. You can get it on Amazon anytime.
Perfect. Thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It is a pleasure. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you. Robert Wise, who is a foremost expert on sexual addiction in the United States, and he's vice president of clinical development with Elements Behavioral Health in Los Angeles. He was also the founder of Sexual Recovery Institute in Los Angeles in 1995. We'll take a break for the news, and we'll come right back.